Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Farm to Table Talk usually brings people to thinking about Portlandia and all those images of people that are being a little pretentious about having their special this and special that. And in fact, all over the United States right now, there are farm to table dinners that people are spending up to $150 a plate to be able to have farm-sourced foods. Well, that's not the only way that farm-to-table takes place. I think it's important for us to kind of get a broader perspective, and we're going to get a really lot broader perspective today because I have a guest with me, and it's Catherine Parker. And Catherine has a unique perspective. She's in mission work in Nepal. She has been in Cambodia, but even before that, she was working with farmers in Iowa, and she's got a master's degree that deals with water. And so, Catherine, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Hi there. It's great to be with you today. I'm so excited to be able to share a little bit about our global food connectional system and how people all around the world are eating together and eating local foods. It's really fun to make these connections. I did start out with my work with farmers, actually in Japan, first of all. That's where I was first introduced to community-supported agriculture.
Whoa. You're right back at the beginning then. I mean, this community-supported agriculture hasn't even been talked about much until probably 5-6 years ago or so. And so you somehow went from the United States to Japan and get involved in community-supported agriculture. How did you do that?
Well, way back in 2000, when I graduated from college, I was looking at programs in the Peace Corps and things like that, and I found out that the United Methodist Church that I'm part of has a program for sending young adults around the world in Peace with Justice programs. So they sent me to Japan to work at the Asian Rural Institute that brings together rural leaders from around the world to think about how we can live together, to study organic agriculture and community development and credit union formation, and to look at the development process in Japan. And of course, community-supported agriculture has been a strong element in Japan for a lot of years. So way back in 2000, it was already quite a movement there in Japan. And that's
That's very, very interesting. I want to come back to Japan, but you also had an Iowa connection too, and you've had some involvement with agriculture and farming in Iowa. Could you explain that?
Right. So after Japan, I came back to my home country, back to the United States, and worked in Iowa with a group called Practical Farmers of Iowa. And they do amazing work to connect small and mid-scale family farms to researchers at the University of Iowa and to engage in participatory on-farm research and farmer-to-farmer sharing, niche market development. We were involved in setting up farmers' markets all around Iowa and getting that farm-to-table activity started. That's back in the early part of this century, back in 2001, 2002 is when I was there.
Well, you know, it's when I think about Iowa, it's one of the quintessential agricultural states. But the movement that you're talking about in Iowa seems to me there's a lot of farmers that were trying to find a way to succeed without getting giant. And in some cases, I believe some of the farmers that had gotten very large decided, wait a minute, I'm having to spend too much on equipment and trying to farm over several counties, and they're trying to get back to a manageable side. And I'm curious, did you in that program work with farmers on both sides, those that were just trying to get started and looking at all these options, and others that maybe had 4 or 5 generations of farmers that are trying to kind of right size and be more sustainable?
Yeah, I really think that PFI, Practical Farmers of Iowa, does try to work with a broad range of farmers at different levels of that activity and trying to develop more farm-to-restaurant, farm-to-school, farm-to-grocery-store direct linkages so that farmers can have a little bit more control over the value chain that they're participating in. We were early engagement with Neiman Ranch and with Organic Valley, some of those cooperative modes of marketing food that allows farmers to be the right size, to support their family, to have a decent income for their family, but also to be connected directly with the consumers.
Well, now this is fascinating. So you ended up, you were in Japan, you're working on a very progressive program there. You come back to Iowa and get involved in the program there. How do you find yourself to Cambodia and then to Nepal?
Well, what I really loved about Practical Farmers was that participatory research, engaging real farmers in research. And I said, this is great. This is something we need to bring into our international development field. So drawing on those connections that I had from Japan with people from around the world, I went back to graduate school. I studied conservation biology, looked specifically at water microbiology, and was working on developing a research methodology that allows people to test their own water source.
Wow, that's impressive. But then getting to Cambodia then, I mean, how did you end up finding yourself after that experience and that training that all of a sudden you're in Cambodia? How did you get there? And describe a little bit of what you did there.
Right. So I was actually invited by the United Methodist Church to come back and to do this work. I thought I was going to go back to Japan, but they asked me to go to Cambodia instead. So that was an eye-opening experience for me. I worked a lot in food security in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. A lot of farmers in Cambodia, as soon as they harvest their rice, they'll sell it off at a low price to pay any debts they have. Mm-hmm. But of course, then when the hungry season comes, when the new mm-hmm. crop hasn't yet been harvested, people have to buy rice at inflated prices. Mm-hmm. So we worked with communities to set up rice banks. The community would build these structures themselves, a local storage unit, in a cooperative way. We'd give them a little initial grant to get about a ton of rice into that, and then they would loan that to themselves. Pay back with a slight amount of interest, much less than the commercial interest, and they would build their local resilience, their local capacity to deal with the hunger issue and to sort of help get farmers out of some of those cycles of debt in Cambodia. So that was some of that work.
So I assume that in Cambodia, rice is a staple, and so it's the main food that people are eating. Are they able to sustain themselves, or do they have to import rice?
Well, that's a little bit confusing. Yes, rice is the staple throughout Asia, Cambodia included. Cambodia is a little bit poorer country compared to its neighbors of Vietnam and Thailand. Cambodia has some pretty effective rice-growing regions, especially up in Battambang, can grow some pretty high-quality rice. Most of that high-quality rice is exported to Thailand. Then the low-quality rice from Thailand is imported to Cambodia, and people buy that to eat. So what we were really looking at with these rice banks as well is really enabling people to eat the rice that they grew themselves, rather than being part of some of that cycling of rice between the wealthier and poorer nations there.
I think we've heard this kind of story before, and so it's kind of a mixed bag, if you will, of the trade relations. When you said that they exported the higher quality and imported the more poor quality, I'm just curious, is there a way to describe what the difference is? Is it difference nutritionally or there, you know, other kind of ingredients that it's just not quite as pure or something?
I think it has to do with the strain of rice, which also has to do with the hardness of the rice and also in the drying process. If you don't properly dry your rice, you get a lot of breakage in the grain. And so when I would eat in very poor families, you have a lot of what we would call shattered rice. So it's not the beautiful grains of nice soft rice that we would expect as a wedding quality rice celebration. So it has both to do with the strain, which has some nutritional elements to it, but also with the process of drying it and the quality then of the.
Well, we've covered three countries here already, and we've got another one to go. And I think I want to start with Beck. We're in contact and working with farmers in Iowa and in Japan and Cambodia. How are they alike and how are they different?
Well, farmers all around the world are compassionate about their community. They're compassionate about the environment. They want to provide the best for the world. And we definitely see that all around the world in farmers really providing food for all of us to eat. And so that's been a strong similarity. Small-scale family farmers as well are, you know, want to make sure that they have a strong and healthy community in which to survive, in which to work, and to take care of the land and to take care of the environment in which they live. So I think those are some of the things that tie farmers together all around the world.
Is there the same interest in, say, in Cambodia, or maybe even Japan as well, and wanting to know whether the food that they're eating was local or identified or feel particularly positive or negative about Cambodian versus U.S. rice or rice from some other country? Is that sort of identity and caring and showing interest, is that important in these other countries that you've been in?
I definitely think that people all around the world are concerned about health. They're concerned about the environment. There's a growing movement in Cambodia, where I worked, and now as well as in Nepal, where I am right now, about people being concerned about eating organic food, eating natural food, not putting those kinds of chemicals into their body, but also about not having those chemicals around the farm, around their livelihoods. One of the issues that was big in Cambodia, a little bit not so much in Nepal, but in Cambodia, most of the fertilizers, most of the herbicides came from Thailand or Vietnam and were not labeled in Khmer, in the local language. So there's quite a bit of work while I was there to get all of those things relabeled in the local language so that farmers knew how to properly apply them to their fields. And so a lot of farmers, because of historic improper use of those, were very aware that there are a lot of dangers associated with improper use of herbicides and chemical fertilizers. And so there has been an increased transition into very traditional composting and methods that build the nutrients within the soil as well.
Boy, that's scary. So they were actually they knew they had pesticides they were going to be putting on, but they weren't able to tell what the instructions were. That happens, I'm afraid, around the world from what I hear. Well, let's get to Nepal, though. Then you move to Nepal, and what's your mission there in Nepal?
Yeah, so 3 years ago, I moved to Nepal, and I actually work these days still in water quality, a lot in maternal and child health, but I'm working in a place called Rukum out in western Nepal, and Rukum is the number one producer of vegetable seeds for all of Nepal. Nepal's up in the high elevation, so a lot of the vegetable seeds that people grow in their kitchen gardens are imported from India. So we've been working with farmers in Rukum to increase their capacity to produce seeds that are adapted to the Nepali environment for vegetable seed production. And that has really been about cooperative formation, getting farmers together, because when they're working together in a cooperative, we can bring in improved technologies that help them to improve their yields. Over the last 5 years, we've actually doubled the yield of vegetable seeds being produced in Rukum. In addition to that, because they're in a cooperative, we've been able to also bring in proper drying systems so that the seeds can be dried in such a way that we get better germination rates. And then again, because we're in a cooperative, we're able to link with the government testing facilities to test those germination rates and get truth in labeling around the vegetable seeds. That increases consumer confidence in the seeds and in turn is able to bring a larger percentage of the market price of those seeds back to the farmers themselves.
Now, I think you mentioned that after the terrible earthquake that took place, that among the things that were happening and all of had so much had to be rebuilt, but even the seed industry, because people had to get back into planting and farms. People think about having bricks and mortars being the casualty of an earthquake, but agriculture and their ability to feed themselves was affected, and you had to step into that, I believe.
Yeah, that was very important. The earthquake happened last April 25th, the major one did, although there's a number of aftershocks. products as well. But many people had not yet planted their fields. The early rains had not yet come. And so people's seed stock was inside their house. And so when their house collapsed, their seed stock was destroyed. So we worked very hard to get seed, to get replacement hoes and farming equipment out to people in those areas so that before the monsoon started, which happened about a month and a half after the earthquake, they could get that crop in the ground. If not, we would have seen another disaster of food insecurity happening the following winter. So we worked really hard in getting seed, both rice seed, millet, corn, potatoes, as well as vegetable seeds out to farmers. First, we got emergency food supplies and shelter, and the second wave of relief supplies was seed stock.
I'm curious, is there a feeling that imported seeds are a threat to those farmers, or is it an asset? Because there's been a lot of publicity about the fact that there's only a handful of seed companies in the world now that control maybe 80-90% of all the seed stock in the world. And some of that are GMOs, which some people have concerns about. So I'm just curious from that local seed industry, how much they might look at outside technology and seed companies as a potential source or a potential threat.
Yeah, I think it's a mixed reaction in Nepal and in other places I've worked in. You know, one of the things we're looking at with our vegetable seed producers in Rukum is really having seed that is adapted to those high mountain environments that are typical of Nepal. So it really is a unique local environment, and we want to have seed that is adapted to those environments because you do get better yield in that regard. But improved seed varieties are important for people because you do want to get the higher yields. And we see mixed results. When we bring in hybrid seeds for corn, you get really improved yields out of that. But people have a tendency to save their seeds and to replant them. And so then after a few successive generations, you really get a drop off in yield, and people then wait for an import of those. So you want to make sure that there are sustainable market solutions for having seed available that is adapted to the local environment and that people can have access to at a reasonable cost. So some people do feel that the open pollinated seeds are a better solution for those areas because of the propensity for people to save seed. But I hear both sides of the stories while I'm there.
Well, I think it's time to skip to the table then. Let's start with all the food that they are produce there and some that they're importing too. What's a typical day of eating? I mean, why don't you start with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so you've been out in many areas in Nepal, but how would they start their day, and what are the foods that everybody's eating?
Yeah, well, being a primarily agricultural community, in Nepal is about 80% subsistence agriculture, people start the morning with a cup of tea, usually black tea in the morning, and then you got to go out and take care of the animals. So that's the start of the morning. About 9 o'clock is when you come in to have your first meal of the day, which is dal bhat. Dal is lentils, a little lentil soup. Bhat is rice, so again, that rice foundation. Little curried vegetable, little cooked saag. Saag is a mustard gree. Little bit of relish, chutney, that kind of usually a tomato-based, sometimes with some sesame seeds ground into it. So that's your main style of meal. We eat that at 9 a.m. and also usually at 7 p.m. in the evening. That kind of food is very similar to what you might see in India, because of course Nepal is just north of India. But Nepal is just south of China, so there's a lot of influence as well from Chinese cooking and Chinese food. So usually between 3 or 5 in the afternoon, we'll have kaja, snack time, which is really a light meal.
But did we skip lunch?
We did skip lunch. There we eat at 9 a.m. and at 7 p.m. Oh. And then we have a snack around 4 to 5 in the afternoon. So no lunch meal there. But Dalbot at 9, I mean, that's a heavy meal. It's a good solid amount of food. Kaja is called snacks because there's no rice.
Oh.
Instead, we eat a little plate of chow mein or samosas or momos. They're my favorite. Momos are similar to pot stickers like you would have in China. But instead of eating them with soy sauce, we eat them with chutney. So a little different flavor there. So that's our kind of snack time, lunch-ish light meal.
So you've been over here now from this trip about 3 months back from Nepal. You're going to be here a while longer. I'm wondering where you find your fix for Nepalese food. Is there you've found as you've been moving? You've been in like 8 or 9 states, I think, on this particular trip. I mean, have you been able to find any good food that's similar to what you would have in Nepal?
Well, one of the fun things that I do with some of the visits that I make to various people around the country is to cook Nepali food together. So momos, what I was telling you about, are great for party food. We make them a lot in fellowship. So friends will invite each other over and we'll have a momo party because they're very labor intensive to fold all those little dumplings together. So we'll sit around the table together. We'll roll out the dough, the pasta dough, into little rounds and fill it up with a filling and put it on the steamer. And then as they come off the steamer, you're just eating and making more of them. It's really a great time of fellowship, and I've loved to be able to share that with some of the communities here in the United States that I have visited as well.
You're going to have to do a blog on this or something. You've got to get this. And in fact, somebody listening to this right now is putting their grocery list together. They're heading to Kroger's or Whole Foods or Raley's or Wegmans or their farmer's market. And is there anything simple that people could, that you might be able to tell them that they could start even look online for, or if they want to get started and make something themselves, you know, what would be kind of easy to kind of get into preparing food like this?
Well, one of the things about Nepali foods that's most special is that chutney, is that little bit of spicy taste. And my favorite chutney is a sesame seed tomato-based one. So you take some sesame seeds, you toast them. Of course, we have Cuisinarts or little food processors here that makes it a lot easier than grinding on the stone. But you put those sesame seeds in the blender and you make a little sesame seed paste. You take some tomatoes, Roma tomatoes that you've maybe peeled, and throw one or two of those in and blend it up. And if you go into the market, you can often find a package of some mixed spices from India and Nepal. Meat masala is really one of the best ones to add. So get some kind of mild peppers and throw a few of those in. Put some of that meat masala in there. Blend it up in your food processor and you've got a great little dipping sauce. And it's great. You can put it on with a little bit of rice. You can make some curried vegetables, and you've got your own fresh little chutney that you can add to your meal there.
Oh, that sounds exciting. Well, you know, you get to follow Bob Seger's advice pretty soon and go back to Kathmandu. That's what I really want to do. It's an old baby boomer coming out in me that I remember Bob Seger instructing us to, we should all head to Kathmandu. Well, you get to head to Kathmandu. And I'm curious, what you're most looking forward to get home again? What is it that you're thinking, it's nice being here, but I can't wait to get home for?
Well, I mean, of course, friends are the most important, and I'm just so excited to get back and to visit with my friends again. But I love the mountains of Nepal. I love being able to wake up and open my door and see the river valley below me and the little peaks up and around the valley there. So the views in Nepal are incredible. The people are wonderful.
Well, I think we should all join you in Kathmandu. Catherine Parker, thanks so much for sharing your story of working with farmers, working with food, working the development work from Cambodia, Iowa, Japan, and Nepal. So, Catherine Parker, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
A joy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.